Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by the number one New York Times bestselling author, David Baldacci, whose new book, To Die For, is the latest 620-man thriller. It's available everywhere. And David, I look forward to this time of year because you always put out a book every fall and we get to chat. But Travis Devine's back. I've been reading this character since the beginning. And what I thought about, I don't know why, but I had the musical Cats in my head and I was thinking about the song The Naming of Cats. When you go about naming a character like Travis Devine, I've repeated the name over and over in my head and it works. When you name a character, how painful of a process is that? Because you know that if this character takes off, you're married to it. You can't change the name.
It is. There's a lot of pressure, and it's a really good point. It's a lot of pressure. For him, you know, it's really weird. Sometimes my most memorable character names come in just in a flash. And I just spent no time thinking about his name at all. Travis Devine. I wanted something that was different, two words you don't normally associate together, and made it unique. Travis, I think I know maybe one Travis in my whole life, and Devine, it's not that usual, the last name. And it just clicked. Amos Decker, my memory man, same thing. It just came to me. But sometimes I agonize over names, and you think you got to get it right because you're stuck with it for life. But luckily for him, I don't know why, that it all came together. I remember sort of sitting at my desk and thinking, this new character is going to take a train in from New York and to Wall Street, and Travis Devine. Okay, that sounds awesome. Let's go with that. Sometimes it's that simple.
Well, I know you do those auctions for charity where people will put their names in a book. And have you ever come across a name in those auctions and think, God, that'd be a great main character name?
Yeah, there have been. In fact, there are four auction winner names in this novel. Betsy Odom, the little girl, Nate Shore, Corey Rose, and Stephen Braddock, who plays a detective. And so sometimes, I take those names and I try to come up with interesting characters for them and give them a lot of page time because I want people to feel like, they got their money's worth for the charity they donated to. And sometimes, yeah, it's like you look at those names sometimes and you think that could be a good main character name. It definitely could be a great peripheral character name. And I've got four of them in this one, so it all worked out well, and I'm sure that people are very excited about reading about themselves in the novel.
Well, Travis is working for Department of Homeland Security. He's kind of with the federal government, but he's hooked up with Betsy Odom, the little girl, and I love the character because she is a very streetwise, street smart young lady, and the dialogue that you had in here, he's protecting her. I don't want to give away too much, but he's protecting her. And so when you came up with this dialogue of this 12-year-old completely smart-ass girl, what was the, as you put those thoughts in your mind, could you hear those conversations being told to you by a little girl? Because, I mean, some of it was almost cringeworthy to hear it coming out of a 12-year-old's mouth.
I know. Well, I raised a daughter, and I don't think she was as over-the-top as Betsy. But what I tried to do with Betsy, I'm going to have to channel this girl. I'm not 12, I'm not a girl, but what were her life experiences? She had it really rough. Her parents did the best they could, but it was not an ideal situation for a little girl. They moved around a lot, didn't have a lot of money, were homeless sometimes. And that's, to survive that, you have to really be tough. You have to learn the ways of the world a lot faster than you normally would if you were in sort of a normal household and with a normal life. So it was a tricky balance. I did want to make her sort of smart ass, because that's, she had to stand up for herself. She used language that, you wouldn't like little kids or even adults to use, but that was just the way that, she came up. So I had to make that authentic. I couldn't have her, speaking like she was going to be attending an Ivy League college. That was not her background. But at the same time, she's 12. And she's in a really traumatic situation. So the fence straddle was, I'm going to make her really, bold and big and brassy, and she's going to tell people off. But then she's going to lose all of her confidence, all of her nerve. She's going to be a little girl who's scared and frightened and vulnerable. So I had to play both sides of her in the book in order for that to be feel real. She couldn't be confident and strong all the way through. Nobody could do that, much less a little girl who's, let's face it, you've only been around for 12 years. You're really not going to know what life is going to throw at you, and you can't deal with things in a mature way all the time. So that was my challenge with Betsy. I really had to give you the two faces of Betsy Odom in this novel.
And then there's a lot of distrust between government operations here. You've got Homeland Security and the FBI at play early on. Neither one of them really trust each other. And then as the reader, I almost sat not trusting any of them to tell the full story. And so you have the whole reliable narrator ass angle, but when you write this, do you find yourself distrusting some of your own characters?
Yes, I do. You know, you know what kind of a game are they playing? You know, what's the real agenda here? Because it's not the one that I think they're trying to keep. And that's just the way of the world. I mean, you have all these big agencies. They all have their bureaucracies. They have their budgets. They have their own agendas. They have goals they want to accomplish. They may not actually align with goals of other agencies that they have to deal with from time to time. So they're always looking out for themselves. I'm not saying they don't cooperate from time to time. I'm just saying that at the end of the day, their individual goals for each individual agency and agent are going to be paramount. They're going to trump anything else that's out there, even the goals of another federal agency that they're supposed to work with. So that's just, I had to write that authentically. You know, I know a lot about those agencies. I know a lot about the people who work in them, and they are loyal to the agency and the bureaucracy that they represent. And if the goals sometimes are misaligned, then that's just the way they're going to play it. It's not going to be all nice in the sandbox. It's just not the way it works.
Something else I did enjoy is this involved a RICO investigation about Betsy Odom's uncle, and there was a whole idea about getting a guardianship over her. And so I've never read a thriller before that involved the idea of a guardianship. And so throwing that in there, is that something the FBI does? Because I never heard of that situation before.
Yeah, you know, I have not heard of that either, but I sort of looked at it logically and thought to myself, okay, I've got the FBI. They have this little girl who may be an important witness, or at least an important chip to play in this bigger game, that they could use her to get something else. So how are they going to gain, you know, power over her? And the only way really to do that is to apply for and receive a guardianship. She's a little girl. The law is very clear on that. You know, you just can't go in, even as a federal agency, you just can't go in and snatch a little girl and say she's mine. You have to go through, you know, the legal gauntlet. And the way to do that was the guardianship. So I thought to myself, okay, I haven't heard about this happening, but if they want to accomplish this goal that I've set up for them in this novel, this is what they're going to have to do. I mean, as a lawyer, I'm intimately familiar with that world as well and the hoops you have to jump through. So that's what I made them do. It also allowed me, as you read the novel, it allowed me a lot of leeway and build up so that I could pull off what I wanted to pull off in the way of the twists and turns in this novel as well. So long as I had the FBI apply for and gain this guardianship over here. So it was really twofold. One was just sort of authentically how they wanted to take advantage of her and control of her to use her in this you know, game that they were playing with Danny Glass and others, her uncle, and also a way for me to have a lot of twists and turns that I could build into the story and do it in a plausible way.
I'm chatting with David Baldacci about his brand new thriller, To Die For. It's a 620-man thriller available everywhere. David, this book deals with one of the themes is the opioid crisis in America comes on the heels of your last book, which I know was a labor of love for you, A Calamity of Souls, which was just a fantastic book that I recommend for anybody. I thought it was one of the best books of the year, but which dealt with a lot of racism. And I know that's near and dear to your heart because growing up in the South, but you seem to have perfected the idea of straddling that line between raising the issues and becoming preachy about it. And I liken it to Shawshank Redemption. They don't tell you how they solved the prison reform. They just tell you the story and let you come up with it yourself. So how is it, as a writer, do you straddle that line and not cross into preachiness?
Yeah, and I've gotten better with that over the years. Sometimes I get on my soapbox too often, and I know that and admit that. So what I try to do is know enough about that world so that I can plausibly lay in to the novel and bits and pieces of dialogue and narrative and plot enough facts that the people will be familiar with what I'm trying to do here. I understand the world. I understand the devastation, the personal devastation that wreaks on people. You know, it ruins lives. It kills people. And if I have that in place, then I don't really have to go and tell them, gee, this is bad. You should do something about it. You should write your congressman. This is a problem for the whole country. Because what I'm showing them that. I don't have to tell them. They see that people are dying. They see that people's lives have been ruined. They see that people are in rehab all the time. They can't hold a job. They have a criminal record. So they are no longer a productive member of society, even though they may want to be. So by showing them all of that stuff, I can just let them arrive at their own conclusions about it. I don't have to all of a sudden break the narrative and say, and by the way, this is bad and evil, and, you know, we all should do something about it. They can see that it's bad and it's evil and it's really hurting the country. So that's the way I've tried to approach these issues now in my novels going forward. I do want them to have a message. I want people to care about these issues because I think they're important. But the way you show it in a novel is very important because you can do it in a way that turns people off, doesn't turn people on.
I know, I'm sure you talk to readers or hear from them. Do you ever have readers reach a conclusion that you didn't expect?
You know, it's, I always say that a book is never finished until the last reader reads it, because that they put their final imprint on it, and every individual has a different take on a novel. Sometimes I'm surprised what people, you know, will focus on and take away from some of my novels. I thought that the A message would be the one that they would most resonate with, and sometimes it's the B or C message. But that's okay, because everybody's bringing, you know, different aspirations and a different background to the story, and people latch on to different things. And that's okay, because I just want them to read the story and take away something from it. It doesn't have to be the entire, you know, plot, the entire everything that I want them to sort of, you know, divine in the pages. But if they take away something from it, then I think I feel like I've done my job. But yeah, I'm continually surprised by people.
I know you're on the forefront of this whole idea of banning books, and you and Michael Connelly are part of a nonprofit that's involved in that. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with that on the front? Because I know we just had a presidential campaign, and that issue, it seems like a hyper-local issue. It doesn't seem to come up on a national level. But what's going on that front now that you and the fantastic author Michael Connelly are so involved with?
Yeah, so we've made a lot of inroads in Florida. Florida and Iowa are apparently the two biggest states. I think Florida accounts for 80% of the banned books across the country. And we made a lot of inroads in the court system to overturn these bans. And, I mean, for me, if you're a parent, and I raised two kids, or, you know, adults now, but if you're a parent and as a child, you should have control over what your kids read. I have no problem with that. My problem becomes when one parent has the control over what all kids in that area will read. So if you take books off the shelf, and not as only is your child, you know, not allowed to read it, nobody else is either, so why should you have that much power over my child? So I have no problem with parental control. I have problems with one parent controlling everybody else's parents. And book banning, look, this country's has flirted with that, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, every, like, 20 years it comes up and rears its ugly head, and it's usually because it's some other issue. It's like, well, there's a lot of bad things going on in the country. It must be because of the books that young kids are reading. And it's ruining them, so we've got to get rid of that. It's not, the books aren't ruining anything. I've seen lots of bad results from no books being in a home. I've never seen a bad result from books being in a home, because books broaden your humanity. They deepen you as an individual. They show you that people from all over the world are pretty much just like you. They want sort of the very similar things. It takes away the boogeyman, the other, the fear of the other, out of it. So I think we've made a lot of progress, and we'll continue to do so, because it's not fair that, for instance, one person could say that book should be taken out of the school library, and it is immediately, and then we don't even know the process for how it's evaluated and whether there's a deadline for it to come back. You know, it may never come back, and we may not know why. So if you're going to do this, at least be transparent about it. So we've made great strides, and the people that we've supported and funded are doing a terrific job.
I know up here in Iowa, the book banning that I've seen generally involves non-heterosexual sex for issues. And so have you seen this around the country in Florida? Is it always a sexual-related issue that gets a book banned, or is it something more?
It's oftentimes a non-heterosexual event. It's also if there's a lot of racism in the book that some people makes kids uncomfortable. My point is that books are supposed to make you uncomfortable. That's how you learn, when you confront things that you weren't anticipated to confront. And people learn from that. I mean, we don't learn from eating vanilla every day. We learn from eating different types of colors every day. And so that's what I see. It's things that make some parents feel like, I don't want my kids exposed to something that makes them feel bad. You know, I mean, James Baldwin, you know, in The Fire Next Time, he said the only way that America gets past its racist history is that we have to confront it completely, you know, warts and all. And then once we confront it, then we can move forward together as a society. But if you keep ignoring it and hiding it and saying, we don't want to know about that, then how are you ever going to get past it? So that books are a way for people to get past it. So it runs the gamut, but it's usually sexually rated outside the norm, what people consider the normal, you know, sex in this country, or racism, or anything that makes people uncomfortable. Those seem to be the three main triggers.
Well, you're fighting the good fight, and you're also entertaining us a couple times a year with new books. This latest book, To Die For, it's the latest 620-man thriller from the number one New York Times bestselling author, David Baldacci. It's a fantastic read. Pick it up and entertain yourself for a few hours. David, just another fantastic offering, and it's so great to talk to you again about it.
Well, I appreciate it. Always good talking to you. Thank you very much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Well,